Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Yeah, I think we can start.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams, and that sound back near you is Rima Crace. Welcome back to Make Me Smart,
Hello.
Where we make today make sense. Kai's out this week. So we've got Rima here, and she is the host of the Marketplace podcast, This is Uncomfortable.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Thank you for joining us today on this Monday, April 1st. The Day of Fools. And
yes, we are, just heads up, we are not planning to play any tricks on you on the show.
We don't have capacity for that.
Yes. I got off the metro this morning, and this guy, and I have headphones in, I'm in my audiobook, and this guy was like, you dropped some money on the ground. And
oh,
I was
God.
Like, and you know, and someone's shouting at me, so I look, he's like, April Fools. I was like, dude. Really?
Why? What are you doing?
Why? And why me?
That feels like out of a sitcom. Like that thing, like, does that actually happen to people? Apparently so, to you.
Like, I was thinking that, I mean, my guard was up. I was like, is this somebody about to attack me and use a distraction
right, that's
to
startling.
Try to, like, rob me?
Yeah.
Instead, it was just like, oh, April Fool's,
oh, right.
not a
Good
physical
one.
Attack. Ha. Anyway, we are not doing April Fools today. We are just going to do some news and some smiles.
Yes.
So, Rima, what caught your attention?
Oh, okay. I'll go first. You know, actually,
yes.
The thing that caught my attention is the thing that you're going to talk about later, and then I pivoted. But we'll get to yours in a minute. So, my news fix is related to the fast fashion industry, which is something I've been thinking about a lot lately because our team over at This Is Uncomfortable has been working on some episodes about this multi-billion dollar industry and its wildly excessive production and all the ways that feeds overconsumption and the exploitation of garment workers. And so this morning I saw this article that piqued my interest about the ultra fast fashion brand known as Shein and how it is currently awaiting approval for a stock market listing. And well, actually, before I keep talking about Shein, how familiar are you with this company?
I'm very familiar with their ads and with Temu and all those things. I've been following mainly the news about how Congress is trying to change the import laws because Shein is getting all of their stuff imported, like, under the cap of how much you have to start paying taxes and tariffs and stuff, and how they're exploiting this loophole, and it's contributing to fast fashion, which I'm sure you all will talk about in the thing.
Yeah, we don't go so deep into Shein in particular, but that's a whole other story in some ways. But it's a fascinating company. It's been on the it's been all over the news for years now. So it's an online brand founded in China more than a decade ago, I believe. And it's known for selling very cheap clothes. Like, I'm talking $5 bathing suits and, you know, $20 floor-length gowns. If you're Gen Z, there's a good chance you know about Shein. The brand is very popular among younger people. I feel like I was first introduced to it through social media. Like, you see these Shein hauls where basically young influencers are usually in their bedrooms and they've got this like huge bag of clothes from Shein that they've just bought, and they dump the items all out and they try them on and they rate them and, you know, try to inspire people to also buy these things. Anyway, so Shein has become one of the most profitable fashion companies in the world. Last year, it recorded sales of about $45 billion. And like I said, it's now awaiting IPO approval. The company is thought to be considering a listing on the London Stock Exchange because it does not think the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission will approve its IPO for several reasons, but, you know, because of the company's heavy presence in China. And I should say, even though Shein was founded in China, it eventually moved its headquarters to Singapore, and it makes all of its sales outside of China now. But lawmakers have said that the company would need to disclose more about its operations in China because, you know, if you're not familiar with this IPO news, there's still a good chance, like I said, you've seen Shein in the headlines for something else. The company has faced allegations over the use of forced labor, specifically exploiting the labor of Uyghurs. It's also dealt with allegations of stealing designs from independent designers and also using toxic chemicals in their clothing. It's a messy company in a lot of ways, which obviously contributes to the skepticism of lawmakers to allow a public offering here in the U.S. So that's, you know, it's been in the news for a little bit, but made headlines today. And so we'll see what happens. It's, yeah, it's fascinating. And honestly, kind of scary to think about just like how massive a lot of these fast fashion companies have become and, you know, how much that contributes to unsustainable practices, both for the environment and for labor, which, again, we will get into in our, you know, our two-part series that we're doing, which actually starts this Thursday on This Is Uncomfortable. So, you know, I would recommend checking that out. Mm-hmm.
I bought a fast fashion dress a couple of weeks ago and didn't realize that I was buying a fast fashion dress because I was looking for an outfit for my cherry blossom party. And I found this dress. And I don't usually buy clothes on Amazon because I'm always suspicious of where it's coming from and everything. Yeah. But the price more or less seemed to align with, like, the type of product I thought I was getting. And, you know, it looked well made and whatever. And I ordered it only to find, to get notified afterwards that it's going to take, like, multiple weeks to get here. It's being shipped directly from China for free shipping. And I was like, okay, I just bought a fast fashion item. It still hasn't arrived yet. And so this dress did not arrive in time for the party, so it may make an appearance next year, depending on how it looks. But this does tie into one of my two newsfix items, which is about, like, just how much things really cost. And one of the reasons I generally try to avoid fast fashion is because I had a friend of mine when I used to work back at NPR who was in fashion school as well and would talk about how much effort and labor it takes to make a piece of clothing, right? And ever since then, and watching her Twitter feed when we were still on Twitter, you know, she would talk about fast fashion quite a bit. And I was just like, And one of her points was, like, if you are buying a piece of clothing that costs $5, it is guaranteed the person making that piece of clothing is not making a livable wage.
No,
the end.
They aren't.
Like, this is just that. Yeah. And so I am always, and I say this from a place of privilege where I can afford to buy clothes that cost more than $5. I try to avoid fast fashion when I can. This really ties in to some stories that I was looking at today. We covered it on Marketplace. It's everywhere else about California's new fast food minimum wage kicking in today. And so for people who haven't been following this, in California, they passed a law so that fast food workers will have to make at least $20 an hour. I'm reading for the New York Times here, significantly above the general statewide minimum of $16 an hour. The law takes effect today, propelling California's fast food workers to near the top of what minimum wage earners make anywhere in the country, second only to the $20.29 an hour minimum for many employees in a very Tukwila, Washington, a small city outside of Seattle. Now, there's all sorts of interesting things about this law and who's covered and who isn't. But if you look over at the Wall Street Journal and many other conservative commentators, they're talking about how bad this is going to be, how it's going to mean franchises might shut down, and how, you know, challenging the argument that raising the minimum wage actually does anything to address poverty. There's a lot of different research about that, most of the time saying that the increases to minimum wage does alleviate poverty. But, you know, I'll let the economists debate that one out. But one of the things they point out in the journal is that there is some research showing that the increase in fast food prices that are likely to come as a result of this will be borne disproportionately by low-income families, people who rely on fast food because it is cheaper than going to a restaurant or because you're working a bunch of jobs and you don't have time to make a meal. There's all sorts of economic knock-on effects of this.
Yeah.
But what it makes me think about is how much stuff actually costs, right? And who pays for us not paying for the full price of something? So in the example of clothing that you were bringing up, if you're paying $5 for a piece of clothing, who is paying the difference? And in that case, it's the worker not making a livable wage and suffering. Or the United States government losing out on the tariffs because they're exploiting a loophole to get this product into the United States without paying, you know, the relevant tariffs or taxes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about fast food, you know, was it ever really a $2 hamburger? Or was it a $2 hamburger subsidized by the person making that hamburger not making a livable wage and therefore relying on government assistance, whether it be Medicaid because their employer wasn't paying for health care, or food stamps, so SNAP benefits, or welfare or cash assistance from the federal government? Somebody was filling that gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you were paying $2 for your burger, you were paying for that in some other way because your tax dollars or some other social structure was filling in for what you weren't paying for in that burger. And more than likely, the worker was also paying for it by having a less than livable structure in their life. And so as the wages increase, especially in these sort of low-paid jobs, products will get more expensive. So does that mean that we as consumers are eating more of that cost and the federal government and these social safety net programs are eating less of it? Does it mean that it's just that the workers are getting some gains and companies are going to use that as an excuse to raise prices even further and more of that profit is going to just go into for shareholders and things like that? But I think it's important as we talk about prices to recognize that for a lot of these goods that have historically been very, very cheap, we have not been paying the full cost of them all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost done with this rant because the Washington Post had a story. The Washington Post had a story a couple of weeks ago about how so many people are complaining at the skyrocketing cost of getting your hair done. Whereas you might remember when you were younger, being able to pay $20, $40, $50 to get your haircut, and now it is literally hundreds of dollars.
$200,
right. All these things. And so just reading a section of this piece, you know, that hairstylists, let me scroll down to this part that I wanted to read, right? Social media has provided a way for stylists to share prices and techniques, creating an online community that stretches from small towns to big cities. And when they started talking to one another, they realized they could look at their business differently. They were barely making any money. The median annual salary for a hairstylist in 2022 was $33,400 a year, or about $16 an hour. Pre-COVID, it was even worse, about $12.54 an hour, or $26,090 annually. They didn't have any money saved for vacation, and if they got sick, they didn't get paid and had to work overtime to get back on track. Charging more or going hourly allows for stylists to create a safety net for themselves. So, were we ever really paying the actual cost of getting your hair done? And so, anyway, this has just been on my mind, you know, as we, because I too complain about high prices. I'm going out less. I'm eating out less. In general, I am consuming less because things are more expensive. But if the trade-off is that the people providing these goods and services are making a livable wage, you know, great. And, you know, here in D.C., restaurants have really been struggling because we increased the tip minimum wage here in D.C., and a lot of restaurants say they can't do it and they're shutting down. It's like, okay, that really sucks. But does this mean the beginning of an end of a business model that was designed to be untenable or to never pay people livable wages? Anyhow.
Wow, that is beautifully said. So much nuance that I feel like I missed in a lot of the coverage reading about this morning. But to your point,
well, I've been thinking there about are a lot this of, for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
I had another story, which is about how there's not going to be any real wealth transfer from the boomers to younger generations because they're going to spend it all on healthcare. But we can talk about
that another day. Oh, okay. We're
let's
reserve
move on
that.
To the smiles.
All right. Let's do smiles.
All right. What's your smile since I just ranted?
Dude, I really struggled with the smile today.
It's like that sometimes.
Yeah. But I did see something a few minutes ago that it made me smile.
Okay.
So there was this, well, there's like a sobering reality to it too, but I'll focus on the positive. So there was an article in CNN about how scientists discovered the fossilized skull of a giant river dolphin, a species that has thought to have fled the ocean and found refuge in Peru's Amazon rivers, I believe. Yes,
okay.
Peru's Amazon rivers 16 million years ago. And so according, there was this really beautiful picture in the CNN article of what this dolphin may have looked like. And according to the fossils, these dolphins are huge, like twice the size of a person, 11 feet long. And the discovery apparently gives some insight into the evolutionary history of freshwater dolphins, because these creatures apparently are extremely rare in the fossil record, because there just aren't a lot of dolphins in freshwater ecosystems, and the strong water currents have made it hard to preserve fossils over time. Anyway, it's fascinating because, you know, it's this remarkable discovery, and it's making scientists wonder how many other records of extinct river dolphins are waiting to be discovered. And I guess the not so happy news is that it also highlights, this discovery highlights the looming risks of the world's remaining river dolphins, which apparently faces similar extinction threats.
Extinction threats.
Anyway,
yeah, it's Monday.
I can't.
I have to say, as soon as I saw this story, all I could think of was that scene from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where the jumping dolphins are like jumping out of the water saying so long and thanks for the fish right before the Earth gets destroyed, which, you know, if you've never seen the movie, it's not funny, but it's funny if you've seen it. speaking of funny, my smile is sort of April Fool's related. It is not actually an April Fool's thing, but it was this great story in the Associated Press about how Gmail, which had its anniversary today, what is it, the 20th anniversary of Gmail, I think? When Gmail launched, apparently, it was so stunning that people thought it was an April Fool's joke because they launched it on April 1st, and Google at the time had sort of a record of doing kind of pretty significant April Fool's Day pranks on people, and they'd been doing them for a couple of years. And Gmail, which seems sort of basic in the internet right now, was really astonishing back in the day. Just reading here from the AP, it was a free service boasting 1 gigabyte of storage per account, an amount that sounds almost pedestrian in an age of 1 terabyte iPhones, but it sounded like a preposterous amount of email capacity back then, enough to store about 13,500 emails before running out of space, compared to just 30 to 60 emails in the then leading webmail services run by Yahoo and Microsoft. That translated into 250 to 500 times more email storage space. And to the point that apparently when they launched it, the Google engineers highlighted to the reporters that there wasn't a delete button easily accessible on the main screen because people wouldn't need to delete email as much because there was so much storage.
Oh,
but
wow.
But yeah, people thought it was an April Fool's Day joke because it was so groundbreaking at the time in 2004.
Yeah, I came across that article this morning too, and it made me smile. I remember there was a line in that article that said, to your point, because they had a history of pulling off these pranks, that one year they said they were going to roll out a scratch and sniff feature on its search engine.
I remember that prank, actually.
Oh, you do?
I remember that prank. Yes, I am that. I'm old enough to remember the Google pranks. I'm also old enough to remember the launch of Facebook.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that. Yeah. Well, I remember even when they rolled out Gmail, I was in high school. And I remember ditching my Yahoo account, sweetandsour435@yahoo, and adopting a more mature adult Gmail account.
I love that you remember it. That you remember that.
And it was a big day. Yeah. I'd religiously check my Gmail every day after school, even though no one would send me anything because I was 13.
And now you wish no one would send you an story. Email.
I know, right? I'm like, please stop.
All right. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, instead of our usual deep dive, we're going to bring you an episode from another one of our amazing Marketplace podcasts. It's from the latest season of Marketplace's Climate Solutions podcast, How We Survive. And Amy Scott and the How We Survive crew are going to go on a road trip to check out some high-tech water solutions that are helping the southwestern U.S. hopefully adapt to the hotter and drier climate, which I know in much of the country will not be very dry this week with these storms coming through. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, look out for that in your feeds. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Our intern is Talia Menchaca.
Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. And Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital. I feel inspired now to go through my Gmail and just delete.
I'm scared to look at it.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.